secret government group on demonic UFOs. Boy, those were engaging, interesting books.
Oh, well, thank you.
Now, you know, Nick, your book, The Real Men in Black, analyzes this phenomenon, the MIBs, from multiple viewpoints. Now, you begin your study of the MIB subject by two archetypal researchers in the field, Albert Bender of Bridgeport, Connecticut, creator of the Space Review magazine and the International Flying Saucer Bureau, the IFSB, and West Virginia ufologist Gray Barker. And you know, Nick, people here in the auditorium are just so thrilled that you're the guest. And you know, Gray Barker, we have our ICAR West Virginia director, Cy Poet, or Joyce, right in the room. She did an excellent recap on Gray Barker's research for Joe Mongeau about 2 years ago. Boy, the MIB phenomenon has quite a history, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's something that really goes back to the early years of the UFO phenomenon. And I think when it comes to the Men in Black mystery, I think a lot of people, particularly those who are new to the UFO subject, a lot of their sort of views, opinions, and conclusions on the Men in Black are sort of largely, not necessarily deliberately, but kind of unconsciously created by the Men in Black movies, you know, starring Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones, which sort of portray the Men in Black as just government agents going around silencing people who've had significant UFO experiences. And certainly that's an aspect of the phenomenon. But when you dig into it at a deeper level, you find the Men in Black mystery is far weirder, and it has sort of paranormal overtones to it as well. So it's not just a case that, you know, there's the government angle. I think there's different classifications of Men in Black. And you're quite right that certainly the early years of Men in Black teachings and history, if you like, do go back to Albert Bender and Gray Barker. And as you pointed out, Albert Bender was someone who established in the early 1950s a group called the International Flying Saucer Bureau, the IFSB, which actually sort of mutated into a huge group with chapters and groups and sort of offshoots all around the world, England, Australia, for example, and went far beyond, I think, even Bender's own expectations. And he published his Space Review magazine for a few issues, kind of a handful of issues, and then brought it to an abrupt halt amid claims that he had this mysterious visit from three men in black who warned him to get out of UFO research and essentially threatened him, you know, just don't return to this field under any circumstances. And that's actually what Bender did, aside from publishing a book in the early 1960s and to set the story straight. But aside from that, he really did just totally quit ufology. And he was well acquainted with Gray Barker, who was, I'm sure you know, was again, in the early formative years of ufology, became a key player in terms of research and book writing. In 1956, he wrote a book called They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers, which told the story of how Albert Bender had set up the IFSB and then got silenced by these three weird-looking guys in black suits. Now, the sort of the inference of the book was that the MIB were government agents, although it was never explicitly said. But when Bender published his own book in 1962 called Flying Saucers and the Three Men, the MIB seemed far more paranormal-based. And I say that because Bender himself had a deep interest in the occult and paranormal phenomena in both the world of fiction and fact. He was very like a big fan of gothic horror literature, but also things like Ouija boards and, you know, contacting deceased entities and things like that. And it was at the height of his UFO research coupled with his paranormal research that he got the visit from these MIB. And contrary to, you know, the perceptions a lot of people have about the MIB from the Hollywood movies, Bender's Men in Black actually sound almost like shadowy, wraith-like creatures with glowing eyes. That's how he described them, that would sort of lurk in the shadows and would kind of exuded menace. You know, they weren't like government agents. They were something far, far stranger. And that's, so it's really Bender and Barker between the two of them. Bender as the person who had the experience and Barker who wrote about it, that kind of really set the wheels in motion for the motif that we have today that's become known as the Men in Black.
Well, you know, your work, Nick, spans the full spectrum on details regarding the MIB, and you do reference key events there where physical people would interrogate or visit UFO experiencers or ET contactees, but also in that paranormal aspect to that in the Final Events book, also in the Contactees book, and in MI in the Real Men in Black book, you mention the concept of the tulpas. This is fascinating. Tulpas as entities, which some say can manifest for mental purpose and focus. You reference as one of the first cases that of, I believe it was the first female lama in Tibet, a woman who was born in France, Alexandra David Neal. And that also you reference this concept that these tulpas can morph as they grow in existence, and that a key aspect is the people must have faith in them or focus on them to keep giving them a purpose for life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is sort of one of the, you know, the different theory or the various theories that have been put forth for what the Men in Black might be. You know, although I'm quite sure that some Men in Black really are regular government agents, flesh and blood. Mm-hmm. A number of them, or a lot of them, sound far weirder. And for these weirder classifications of Men in Black, one of the theories that's been put forward is this relative to so-called tulpas. And tulpas, essentially, it's a Tibetan concept originally, and the idea is that like the mind can, if it focuses on a particular image or a form, and deeply concentrates and meditates on that image in the mind for days and weeks, that we can actually kind of externalize that imagery and create like a, almost like give birth to like what you might call a mind monster or something like that, that you project outwardly an unconscious image which actually has some sort of semblance of reality in the real world. And it's a strange concept. You know, it's a perfect example might be, you know, someone focuses on their mind for 2 or 3 weeks, deeply meditates on the image of, say, a large wolf with glowing red eyes. And then 3 weeks later, the local newspaper reports on somebody who's seen this huge wolf with glowing red eyes racing across the road in front of their car. In other words, you've mentally concentrated on this image, and you've kind of given it some semblance of reality in the real world. And some people believe that may be what the Men in Black are, that they're kind of like a tulpa-style creation that has some sort of self-awareness of its own. And what happens is that according to teachings, the tulpa has to, the only way it can survive and thrive is on human emotion. So what it does, it frightens UFO witnesses into a state of fear and then feeds upon that emotion like an emotional vampire, if you like, rather than a blood-sucking vampire from ancient legend, and possibly, you know, it's been speculated that's specifically why the Men in Black instill fear in people, because they literally bleed the witness dry of emotion. And a number of witnesses have actually said that they felt that the Men in Black, after the experience, they felt drained. The best way you can describe is kind of like a diabetic who's not eaten all day. You know, at 9 o'clock at night, they start crashing, and the body just shuts down, they get weak, tired, and shaky. That's how a lot of witnesses to MIB encounters react. They literally go into like a state of, you know, like hyperglycemia. You know, somebody just needs a sugar fix. You know, and you could argue that's a perfect example of somebody being drained of that emotion by entities that need that emotion to survive.
Boy, that's interesting. And here I want to direct a question to our virtual there. We have a number of researchers and our wonderful room members and visitors. Can you hear Nick well? You know, I know that you probably can hear me very well, but I want to make sure that everyone in... Oh, good. Thank you very much, Joyce. Thank you, Saipuet. Now, Nick, if you could just confirm that I correctly understood this concept in your book, I thought it was very well done. Is it true that you seem to allude in your book to the importance of heightened focus on ufology or other phenomenon which possibly could draw the attention of a tulpa?
Yeah, I think what happened, my experience has been in interviewing witnesses, is that for some reason, which I'll admit I don't have a full understanding of how and why, but it's almost like when you get involved in this phenomena, the phenomena seems to know you're looking into it, and it kind of, in some cases, turns the tables on you, sometimes from a positive learning perspective, but other times it can be quite of a malevolence experience as well, to the point where, you know, it can create like a backlash, and a negative backlash. But I think, you know, there's a very strong grounds for saying that the more you look into these phenomena, the phenomena themselves realize. It's like you kind of come up on their radar, and then they get their grips into you. And that's something that happens with the Men in Black. I think you begin investigating and looking into UFOs, and whatever the origin of the Men in Black mystery, that's when they come calling, when somebody gets significantly close to the truth, if you like.
Thank you, Ian. That's an excellent explanation. Very intriguing. Now, have I lowered my voice? I've been told that I'm speaking at too high a volume, but they'd like you to speak up a little bit. Your words are so important, Nick, and also to Joe, our wonderful network owner. Joe, if you could increase Nick Redfern's volume a bit, too, as well.
I'm actually on a regular landline with the cords, so maybe just some sort of interference. I don't, we've actually got storms here right now, and the wind's howling. Maybe that's got something to do with it, so.
Oh, good for you for even being a guest. And I'm just thrilled
that
you're a guest this evening. Everyone is really very excited that you're being that you're a guest tonight. And now everyone's saying that the clarity is great. Thank you so much, VZ and Time Lord. Great. Thanks, Cy, very much. Now, you know, I noticed in your book, too, you gave a great concept that MIBs can either be government, intelligence, or military agents, or they can also be the paranormal. And in the former category, the actual physical government, military, or intelligence, am I interpreting this correctly, agents? I'm hoping I'm correctly noting that for you, Nick, that you reference that the contactees in your work, Contactees, A History of Alien-Human Interaction, that, for example, the FBI had extensive on such major contactee figures as Adamski and Van Tassel, while at the same time Adamski might have been a government agent.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the interesting things about the contactee mystery. You know, for people who aren't fully aware of the contactee issue, what it's all about. Essentially, back in the early to mid-1950s, many people across the United States claimed contact with very eerily human-looking aliens with long blonde hair, but very much human-like, but perhaps about 6'5", 6'6", so a lot taller. And of course, you know, even for men in the 1950s, you wouldn't see many American men with long blonde hair. You know, so they kind of stood out, and people would claim experiences out in the desert late at night. And the so-called Space Brothers, as they became known, would make contact with these people who became known as the contactees and ask them to spread the extraterrestrial word, if you like, of living in peace and harmony together. And that's what many of them did. But you're quite right. If you look into the subject, you find there are a lot of crossovers between government involvements in UFOs and the contactees, to the point where some of the contactees may have been government people trying to confuse the phenomena. He actually didn't get to the heart of the matter, you know, the truth, rather than, you know, enlightening us. It seemed like that, but it may have been sort of a confusion. And we find this a lot where we get crossovers between governments and genuine UFO activity, to where it sort of boggles the mind as to where one begins and the other one starts, so to speak.
Well, that's very intriguing. Thank you, Nick. Now, you know, Nick, on Van Tassel, too, what an interesting individual. You reference in Contactees that Van Tassel might have known some FBI agents. You note material obtained from the Freedom of Information Act, which notes Van Tassel's acquaintance with an FBI agent named Bort, and that Van Tassel helped Bort with many cases at Lockheed. Also, off on a tangent, Van Tassel was an assistant to Howard Hughes while employed at Hughes Aircraft. I hope I remember that correctly. I have a note here, page 179.
Yeah, I mean, Van Tassel was a very interesting character. George Van Tassel was someone who claimed a classic UFO encounter in the early 1950s at a place called Giant Rock in California, which is a couple of hours' drive outside of Los Angeles, near a place called Landers, a town called Landers. And he claimed that in the early 50s, he was kind of inspired, not really knowing why, to go out to a desert location near Giant Rock and just literally wait. And that's what he did. And he said, like, a definitive flying saucer-type craft came down, and essentially just manifested before him, and this long-haired alien got out of the craft, and essentially there was this kind of spiritual message where you would have the alien saying, you know, we want you to go and spread the word that the world's on the brink of nuclear destruction, and in your own way spread that word. And what Van Tassel did was to set up yearly conferences out at Giant Rock, which at their height were actually in the mid-50s, were attracting audiences in figures of 12,000. And, you know, that's pretty significant for a UFO conference. And so, you know, in that respect, you know, it was a significant movement in the UFO field. But people have, you know, asked, were Van Tassel's experiences, you know, with genuine aliens? Was he being deceived as part of some weird government plot to confuse the subject even more? Or possibly, as some people believe, that some of the contactees were actually assisting the government in trying to prepare people for a discussion of UFO reality. So, you know, this is why I find the whole contactee movement so fascinating, because there's no doubt in my mind that the majority of the contactees had absolutely genuine experiences with something non-human. But equally, they seem to have been approached by government people who try to recruit them into their projects of a UFO nature as well. It becomes a really complicated, convoluted story where, you know, even though I've written a book on the subject, you know, even I find myself scratching my head trying to figure out, you know, what their real motivations were.
You know, that's an excellent point. Those are all excellent points, Nick. And reading your works, I note here that there seems to be a segment of the government, intelligence, military, and so forth, that are very interested in, for example, ET communications through telepathy as an additional physical ability versus the possibility that it could have a paranormal aspect. And, boy, I just, the way you detail that is excellent. Now, this is off on a tangent, but I had to say it. I thought it was really exciting. J. Edgar Hoover obtained a copy of Gray Barker's They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. Well, I guess the FBI was interested.
Yeah, this is a weird thing. You know, it's like those of us, or a lot of people who do UFO research, assume that the men in black originate with the government. And so, you know, to find, as I did, I often used the Freedom of Information Act to get hold of government files on UFOs. And I filed with the FBI for Gray Barker and Albert Bender, not really expecting necessarily to get anything, but I'm very surprised and pleasantly surprised to find that the FBI replied that, yes, we have files on Bender and Barker, and here they are. They sent me copies. And the files actually show that none other than J. Edgar Hoover wanted to try and get to the bottom of the MIB mystery, and actually ordered one of his agents to get a hold of a copy of, as you pointed out, of Gray Barker's book. So we have this ironic situation where we, as UFO researchers and investigators, think the government are the originators of the Men in Black mystery, and then we find FBI files where J. Edgar Hoover's asking the question, who are these guys in black suits running around silencing UFO witnesses? You know, it's almost like they're as much in the dark as we are, which leads me to believe, because these are genuine files, leads me to believe that what we're seeing is evidence that the government is not responsible for the majority of the stranger MIB encounters, that they originate somewhere else, because the government appears to be as baffled as we are, but are as deeply interested as we are in resolving the mystery.
Yes, indeed. You know, you refer to that in your final events book, and also contactees and MIB, just to really unravel this enigma of the UFO and ET presence. Now, I'm going to lower my volume a bit, and Nick, if you could just continue speaking up a bit, I want to make sure, for example, during podcasts, that people want to put the volume right up to hear your great commentary. Now, Nick, I'd like to turn to a really interesting case, the Mothman. You detail beautifully in your The Real Men in Black book the events and reactions to the Mothman accounts of activities that impacted the Point Pleasant, West Virginia area, with the activity focal point at the old Point Pleasant TNT warehouse area. Researcher John Keel wrote of these events in the Mothman Prophecies, as you note. And you also note the presence of Mary Heyer, a journalist in the Point Pleasant area and correspondent for The Messenger, a newspaper in Athens, West Virginia. Oh, that is really a fascinating story.
Yeah, the Mothman story, you know, I think most people, if they haven't read John Keel's book, The Mothman Prophecies, a lot of people will certainly have seen the Hollywood movie of the same name starring Richard Gere, which was made in 2002. And it tells the story of this weird creature that descended quite lit on the town of Point Pleasant, West Virginia, in the period from about late 65, 66, through the latter part of 1967. And although the name Mothman, you know, it kind of creates like a sort of a cartoonish Batman-type imagery, Mothman wasn't like that at all. It was more like a shadowy, spectral creature, sort of backlight wings and glowing eyes, that often was described as sort of being seen through peripheral vision rather than, you know, literally in you know, 3D reality, so to speak. So it was very ominous, almost unsettling, menacing type entity as people that would manifest before people. And the Mothman sightings culminated in the latter part of 1967 with the collapse of the Silver Bridge, as it was known, in Point Pleasant, and the deaths of literally dozens of people who drowned when their cars just fell off the bridge and collapsed into the waters of the Ohio River. Now, that's strange enough on its own, that you have Mothman kind of appearing before there was this sort of dark tragedy and doom. And some people view Mothman as kind of like a precursor or a causer of doom. But a lot of researchers today take the view that Mothman may well be some sort of entity that warns when disaster is looming and tries actually to alert people rather than cause the disaster itself. But regardless of, you know, which scenario is correct, throughout this entire period when Mothman was seen in Point Pleasant, we had countless MIB encounters in the very same area as well. Now, these MIB encounters, again, don't sound anything like government people at all. For example, Mary Heyer, you mentioned, who was a journalist on one of the local newspapers, she spoke about how these particular MIB, you know, she'd be working late in the offices, for example, and, you know, they would literally enter and start talking about UFO encounters that had been reported in the local newspaper, and she described them as sort of being 5 feet tall at the most, and with lifts in their shoes as well, at that height. And they seemed to have very pale skin, pasty-looking, almost anorexic-like. They didn't seem very conversant with our ways and customs. And in many respects, they actually sounded almost like alien entities that looked very much like us, but who were kind of disguising and camouflaging themselves to a degree so they could move amongst us. In other words, they weren't sort of the classic bug-eyed greys that we hear of today, but they sound more like, almost like a hybrid type cross between an alien and a human, that's wearing sort of pull-down fedora type hats and wraparound sunglasses and trench coats with, you know, turned up collars and largely only surfacing at night. They could act with us without being giving some too much notice to themselves, and you know, almost trying to infiltrate us and learn what we knew about the UFO phenomenon. And it's kind of like an unsettling thing to imagine these sort of hybrid type aliens camouflaging themselves with black clothes and, you know, surfacing at 10 o'clock at night and sort of roaming the cities, silencing people about their UFO experiences. But that's exactly what the sort of the Mothman saga kind of provokes, that imagery.
You know, yes, it does. And I have an excellent question from one of our researchers in the auditorium. But just off on an aside now, Nick, and thank you so much for reminding me of this. I should really have immediately asked your description of what the MIB look like. Of course, pale. You gave a great description there. Very pale complexion, clothed in black. And, you know, in that sort of black stereotypical suit and black fedora or Homburg garb, it references the great notation. You get different explanations for possible MIT sources or providences. And you mention paranormal researcher Joshua P. Warren's research on time travel possibilities.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that Joseph P. Warren thinks that perhaps some of these men in black could be individuals monitoring the different paratemporal time loops, and that they choose these black outfits because they would more or less fit in within a couple of hundred years to wherever they visit. That was a very good point.
Yeah, I mean, Josh is a good friend of mine, and he, when I was doing research for the book and looking into theories, you know, Josh said, well, I have a great theory that I think you may want to learn more about. And that's, you know, exactly what happened. I interviewed Josh extensively for the book, and he's a very, Josh is a well-published author on primarily ghost-related issues, but he has a deep interest in UFOs as well. And, you know, one of Josh's big questions when it comes to the Men in Black is, you know, why do they wear black? Why do they wear the black suits? And as Josh quite rightly pointed out, you know, that if Josh, one of Josh's bigger areas also, I should say, is time travel. You know, the idea that the past, present, future may not be sort of cast and set in stone, that they can actually be manipulated, and possibly we may have sort of time travelers, time surfers from the future, coming back and manipulating the timelines for the benefit of the future, but, you know, not necessarily for the benefit of the present or the past. And Josh speculated on the possibility that the reason why the Men in Black wear black suits is because they are, I guess, in one respect, time surfers or time travelers, and that if you're operating in, say, 2011 or 1985 or 1965 or 1940 or even 1920, you could wearing a definitively black suit and tie, and even the fedora. You know, the fedora might look a bit out of place today, but you probably wouldn't draw too much attention. You just think, oh, it's a cowboy wearing a hat. But you could conceivably wear that outfit at pretty much any point in the last 100 years and mingle amongst people. And Josh speculated on the theory that perhaps the Men in Black aren't sort of our worst nightmare, but they may be what you might call in simplistic terms time cops, whose job it is to prevent, I guess, entities, threatening entities or hostile entities in the future who might want to alter the timelines for their benefit, that the Men in Black actually appear to try and prevent these time paradoxes from occurring, and when they do, to try and reset the balance so, you know, people in the future or the present don't wink out of existence because something obliterated them, you know, when they should have been born in 1965 or 1970. And it's a fascinating theory, you know, that the idea that why they turn up out of the, why the MIB turn up kind of out of the blue, why they see their clothing fashion sometimes seem to be a little bit out of date with the fedora hats. And even more importantly, they often wear, they often drive old style cars like 1960s Lincolns, even in the present day. And in England, they often they're seen driving some 1960s era Jaguar cars. So, in other words, everything about the Men in Black kind of screams out of time and out of date. And, you know, I think this is one of the reasons why I spent so much time speaking with Joss and addressing that theory in the book, because look at it, you know, if time travel is feasible and real, that particular theory for the MIB actually makes a lot of sense.
Yes, it very much does. And, you know, your discussion on the possible sources for the MIBs goes into great detail. It's very intriguing. You mentioned Dr. Bruce Goldberg thinking that they might be adept in traveling the fifth dimension. Also, you referenced Jim Peniston, the former U.S. Air Force serviceman who was on military duty there and witnessed the Rendlesham Forest incidents in December 1980. And also, later, I'd love to bring up the work as well of Anglican priest Ray Boyce. Is that how you pronounce the name?
Boyce,
thank you. Ray Boyce. And that they might, he believes that they are there of a demonic either motivation or provenance. Nick, can I ask you a question sort of off on the side? It's off on a tangent, but it's brilliant. One of our researchers is Norris Boy. He always asks brilliant questions. It must be one of his research projects, is E.T. contact with Native Americans. Now, this is on the E.T. subject. Are you familiar with E.T. contact with Native Americans about 500 years ago? If so, what appeared in the oral traditions or petroglyphs? And he adds a little note here, contact with Indians in Ohio specifically, it must be.
Well, that's a great question, Teresa. Unfortunately, I'm not that conversant with
me
that
too.
Subject, no. You know, I mean, if I can answer a question, I will, but I don't kind of want to, you know, have to try, you know, tell somebody I know the answer and spin it out. I truthfully don't know too much. One of the reasons being that, you know, I think there are a lot of people out there who do good research into sort of very, you know, the sort of ancient astronaut aspect of the UFO phenomenon going back hundreds of years or thousands of years, and because a lot of people have done and are still doing a lot of good research in that area, I tend to sort of focus my areas of research on those which I feel more conversant, knowledgeable of, and comfortable with, you know. So, you know, I think it's better to focus on certain things rather than sort of spread far and wide and have a sort of a vague knowledge of a lot of things rather than, you know, a solid knowledge of a smaller number. So, unfortunately, I wish I could answer the question better, but I truthfully don't know much about that Ohio Native American Indian phenomenon at all, unfortunately, no.
Well, Nick, your expertise in many of the fields goes into very great depth. I don't know if we'll even get into Bigfoot tonight, but you really have studied many of these fields with great detail and focus. Another question coming in, this is on time travel. One of our favorite room researchers, who also is an astronomer and musician, Ian S.P., his question is, it's on the time travel subject. What scientific evidence is there to support the possibility of time travel, and has the guest ever stopped to think what other times existing along with our own world would require? Boy, that sounds like that what is that concept? Oh, I had it right here. The Joseph Warren noted the paratemporal loops or whatever. I had it right here.
Well, I mean, you know, in fairness, I'll be the first to admit, and as I point out in the book, you know, the concept of time travel, very much that, it's a concept. You know, if we had hard proof that people from some future time were traveling into their distant past, which in many respects we would call our present, you know, all questions would be answered. But rather than having sort of hard facts, we have a lot of deep suspicions. And I think, you know, stories like and theories like those of Joshua Warren, they make a lot of sense. But at the end of the day, it is still a theory. But I think it's an important and a significant theory that needs to be addressed. And, you know, you point out people like Dr. Bruce Goldberg and various authors who've written books on the entire theory, if you like, that, you know, our UFO visitors are actually not extraterrestrial, but somebody from our future coming back to visit us, possibly for, you know, who knows what reason, scientific, archaeological, who knows. And so in that respect, you know, we're sort of forced from many angles, if you like, to address this issue from a theoretical perspective. But that doesn't necessarily mean it has no merit. And of course, you know, when you get into time travel, you do get into some very, very weird areas and, you know, looking at things, you've killed someone in the past. You know, does that obliterate their existence in the future? Or does it create a new timeline that runs parallel with your existing timeline? So in other words, let's say, for example, you know, you have somebody named John Smith, and John Smith's parents are killed in the past by a time traveler, so John Smith is never born. Does that mean he immediately disappears in our reality, or does he continue living, but then there's like another divergence of reality in the past where he was never born? So in other words, do we have multiple timelines rather than just manipulating one timeline? And I think, you know, these are all important factors that, you know, that can kind of boggle your mind and make your head spin trying to get your logical theorizing around them. But I think, you know, anything that sort of sheds light or potentially sheds light on these puzzles, we should look into, no matter how bizarre or controversial the theory might be, because it could be that one untapped theory that answers all the questions.
That's a great response. Thank you, Nick.
Sure.
I have a further comment. It's a very good question from the room, another great question. But now before it, I'm going to note this account from your book. It's a vignette. You had mentioned that in 1972, a former FBI employee, Patricia Hyde, allegedly witnessed a UFO sighting over Arcadia, Florida. Afterwards, she received more than one Men in Black visit with the admonition to not further study the UFO topic. Apparently, Timothy Green Beckley was one of the researchers on her case. And here, New York Lily, one of our researchers, excellent researcher, and director, the ICAR director for New York State, and New York Lily has a question for you. Nick, have MIBs ever harassed abductees or contactees?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly less so with contactees, but I have a whole chapter in the book on the liaison between, or connection between, MIB activity and people who've had alien abduction experiences. I'll give you a perfect example. One of the people I interviewed for the book was Marie Jones, who's a a well-known author of books on everything from the 2012 controversy to just a whole range of sort of paranormal and supernatural issues, a wide range of issues. And Marie, back in the 1990s, became deeply involved with the abduction mystery. And it was at the height of her research into alien abductions that she began to get, she was liaising with actually a friend and colleague of hers who began to get visitations from these weird looking men in black, essentially harassing her and telling her not to talk about these experiences. This is Marie's friend. And at the same time, Marie was getting weird phone calls and where it seemed like she was being secretly watched and spied upon by these characters. And for both Marie and her friend, it created like a high degree of stress, which both of them concluded was relative to their abduction research. And Marie concluded also that these MIB were intent on trying to intimidate Marie into getting out of abduction research, which in fact she walked away from the phenomenon because it got so stressful and disturbing for her to be being harassed by these sort of strange characters. Another example, one of the people I interviewed for the book, a researcher and author named Christopher O'Brien. Chris had investigated a case in Colorado where he lives, where an abductee, her mail kept going missing, or it would arrive sort of tampered and opened and resealed. And so she staked out the mailbox. She lived on like a large property, and the mailbox was sort of half a mile down, you know, at the end of the dusty highway. And she kept like a close, stealthy watch on the mailbox to see this old-fashioned black car turn up one morning and two guys in black suits and the classic fedora hats rifling through her mail until she sort of screamed out and they, you know, jumped back in the car and shot off at high speed. And these are just two examples of MIB crossovers with the abduction mystery. And I think, again, it makes me conclude that the MIB, or some of them at least, are intent on preventing us learning the truth about certain aspects of the UFO phenomenon, like the agenda behind abductions. You know, somebody gets a little bit too close to something, and suddenly the MIB pop up and start, you know, intimidating and kind of bullying people out of the subject.
Excellent response. Excellent answer, Nick. You know, on that Chris O'Brien case that you go into detail on in your book, I guess it was the one happened around 1994 and 1995 in Colorado. There was a major UFO flap, you note, at that time, San Luis Valley. I always mispronounce that. San Luis Valley, I think it's pronounced here. But you note that the case was referred to researcher Chris O'Brien by the Colorado Sheriff's Office.
Yes.
I find that very intriguing. We have a wonderful Colorado researcher, Chuck Zukowski, who is a ufologist, archaeologist, researcher. He's done a great deal of work there in the San Luis Valley.
Yeah, I mean, you get areas like the San Luis Valley that seem to be almost like portals where you get a wide and varied range of strange activity going on. Where I'm originally from in England, I lived about 2 miles from a large area of forest called the Cannock Chase, which, like the San Luis Valley, was like a magnet for weird activity of UFOs, Bigfoot, strange creatures, weird lights flitting through the woods, contactee cases, abductions, you name it, it happened. And I think there is something to the idea that certain parts of our world may represent kind of what we might call portals or doorways to other realms. I sometimes sort of speculate on the idea that our aliens they're alien in the sense they're not human, but I sometimes wonder if they're not actually extraterrestrial, but are more kind of extra-dimensional, and they sort of zip in and out of our reality, not from some faraway star system, but from another realm of existence that kind of coexists alongside us. In simplistic terms, you know, kind of tuning your radio in from one station to another. You know, all those stations are still going on at the same time, but you can only tune into one at any given moment. And I think that possibly going on with some of these locations like the San Luis Valley, where we get so much strange activity concentrated in such a one particular area. And I think, you know, that could explain some of these aspects of the phenomenon, like the MIB, the abductions, UFO encounters, things like that, all, you know, concentrated in that area that reached Chris.
Boy, that's very intriguing information, Nick. Now, you know, with your extensive details on the MIB phenomena in your book, The Real Men in Black, Nick, you reference that odd behavior with the MIB incidents can include tampering with phones, odd phone reception, voices that sometimes can seem as though they are robotic or otherwise altered. Now, I know the Stan Romanek case does have instances of unusual phone recordings, and often aside, Joe Montaldo, host of UFO Undercover, did a great interview with Stan Romanek this past Wednesday, another great interview with him. Now, Nick, what strikes you as the most unusual of the anomalous phone incidents with this MIB tampering of phones, reportedly?
Well, I think more than anything else, it seems to be the case that the MIB seems to know when we're looking into significance. You know, it's like, often people don't report or talk about the things they're investigating, but the MIB seem to know when it's time for them to come calling. You know, it's almost like they have sort of some innate, weird way of knowing that when it's time for them to sort of try and silence people. And we get a lot of this within the entire sort of UFO spectrum, if you like, from the perspective of, you know, silencing people and making intimidating calls, telephone interference, you know, lines going dead and having to keep getting the phone company out and all sorts of things like this. And I think, you know, a lot of it, I think, is done deliberately. It's kind of a form of intimidation where the MIB actually want to let us know, you know, that they're listening in. You know, if they're listening in and it's not intimidating the person, it's, you know, they're kind of failing in their action to silence people. They actually want people to know. And I think that's the same with sort of mail tampering, that they deliberately tamper with mail so we can tell it's been tampered with as a means to try and, you know, instill people to leave the subject, if you like, if they're particularly of kind of like a, you know, a frightened mind.
Thank you. That's a very intriguing response. Thank you, Nick. Nick, we have an additional question coming in. It's from a senior researcher of ICAR. He is from the upper Midwest area. He wants to know, Nick, if you could go and view anything forward, now, or in the past in any paranormal area of study, possibly with an invisible switch, what area or thing would you choose?
I think I'll probably choose Roswell, and I think for more than any other reason that, you know, the Roswell event, whatever happened, sort of really defined the early years of ufology, and it's one, probably the one case more than any other that, you know, the UFO subject really puts on a pedestal. So I think if I could go back, you know, and see what happened at Roswell, that would be sort of the perfect, you know, the perfect case for me, and, you know, I could finally say, we know what really happened at Roswell, and we've got the story straight, and we know the government response, and so yeah, I think that would be the one more than any other.
You know, Nick, that's a very apt response. There's so much still going on with Roswell. You know, Chuck Zukowski, that ufologist, researcher, and archaeologist, together with his sister, Debbie Ziegelmeyer, team member Matt, and others, are still doing very important archaeological research at the Roswell's new developments, and also their new theories, or theories that I hadn't heard of before, from Charles Hall, also Clifford Stone, perhaps the theories of Mr. Hall and Mr. Stone, others have heard long before I did. But that Roswell subject matter always seems to be expanding with some interesting new fact or development occurring.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Roswell is one of these cases I think is never going to go away because we're always uncovering new material or, you know, somebody comes forward where their grandfather told a deathbed story about their involvement in the case. And I think, you know, whatever happened, Roswell, you know, is never going to go away. It's really reached that status of sort of being the premier UFO event. And, you know, how it kind of impacts upon the UFO subject, I think, is equally as important as what actually happened. But, you know, the biggest problem, the biggest challenge is how we get the proof of what happened. You know, I mean, the testimony is great. You know, it's a, without the witnesses are arguably the most important people in ufology because they're the ones who've had the experiences. But the problem with Roswell, we need to get past just the witnesses and find, you know, the hard evidence and the files prepared at the time on what actually occurred. If we can get those, we stand a chance of resolving it. But right now, we're kind of in that brick wall situation of not being able to get beyond, you know, the witness testimony and take it further to who might be sort of sitting on those ancient files from 60 years ago.
Excellent comment. Nick, you also touched upon an important case on which you gave a presentation, one of your several, at the UFO crash retrieval conferences in Las Vegas. Now, this was concerning the January 1974 Berwyn Mountain Range event. Am I correct? It's really Britain's Roswell. Nick, you referenced the possibility that some UFO researchers might incorrectly be considered MIBs. Here you reference the excitement around the January 1974 Berwyn Mountain Range event, and then there was a question as to which investigators were there regarding craft, witness information, so forth. Great deal of activity there.
Yeah, I mean, the Berwyn Mountain case is a very weird and strange one because it has so many strands to it, and it has become known as like the definitive British Roswell. The story is that in January 1974, what we know for sure is that something occurred on a remote mountain range in North Wales in the United Kingdom called the Berwyn Mountains. And the events involved strange lights being seen in the sky of what felt like an impact of something crashing into the mountain, like an earth tremor, strange lights zipping across the sky, reports of military cordons in the area and roads sealed off and things like this, and people being warned not to talk about whatever it was that occurred. And this has led to sort of a creation of Men in Black type characters roaming around the little ancient villages in North Wales, silencing people. Now, I point out in the book that some of these stories may actually be based upon genuine government people going out trying to determine what had happened, which, you know, in one respect, they are, I guess, MIB. But they're not sort of the definitively weird MIB. But even though they might have sort of prosaic explanation, this doesn't also take away the fact that, you know, something strange did appear to have happened in the Berwyn Range. And I think, you know, that's an important factor in itself, that the event kind of polarizes certainly the British UFO research community into several camps. You know, the idea that could it have just been an earth tremor and a meteorite shower occurring at the same time, or was it a real UFO crash event that was successfully hidden by the British government? You know, there are people who are in one camp and people in another. But it's interesting that in significant cases like this, again, we get the rumors and the legends of the Men in Black starting to surface. So I think it's an important case that's still, in many respects, wide open.
Thank you for that information, Nick. Now, we have about 2 minutes until the first break. It'll be a 10-minute break. But now, Nick, at this point, I was wondering if I could mention a great case that you reference in at least two of your books. It's the 1962 event when a 16-year-old girl from Britain, Anne Henson, witnessed a UFO. She contacted a nearby Royal Air Force base, Chivenor. I hope I'm correctly pronouncing it, Chivenor. She received a response, and she actually had a Royal Air Force official visit her farm home. He did take the photographs of the object, compass drawings, and notes. He saw the photograph. He saw the object, and then he was identified later when British Ministry of Defense files were declassified as Sergeant J.W. Scott, a member of the Provost and Security Services of the British Royal Air Force. They're taking this seriously.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is an example, a perfect example of where we have the Men in Black, where we can trace some of them back to government activity. I mean, I interviewed Anne back in the 1990s, and she told me this story, how when she was a girl in the 1960s, she'd seen this UFO in this sort of remote country, rural area where she lived, over the course of several nights in the early hours of the morning, contacted a local base, and somebody came out to visit her. You know, she expected a guy in a uniform, but everything about the visit was sort of strange. Instead of being during daylight hours, it was late at night, and he turned up in this old black car, dressed in a black suit, confiscated, as you point out, her compass drawings, and basically told her not to talk about the experience with anyone, which is all classic aspects and facets of the Men in Black mystery. And from there, you know, it sort of entered Men in Black mythology and lore. You know, people said, well, this is the classic Men in Black encounter, but where's the proof? Which they say about a lot of cases. And we would have been without proof had it not been for the fact that a few years later, very quietly, the British government when the provisions of the sort of Freedom of Information Act came into being and government files began to be released, they actually officially released the files on Anne's case. And as you point out, it identified the man as a Sergeant J.W. Scott from an arm of the British Royal Air Force that was involved in counterintelligence and security-related issues. So, in other words, we can certainly pinpoint some men in black as being with the government. Now, there was nothing odd-looking, as Anne said, about her visitor. He was just dressed in black and told her not to talk about her experience. So I think this category of man in black is different to the sort of emaciated, pale-looking men in black. You know, this is where the mystery gets really weird, because there seem to be several category of men in black running around, silencing people, not just one. And, you know, and the government doesn't seem to have a full understanding of who these other MIB are. And where it's made even more confusing, the government MIB dress like the weirder MIB. So, you know, it sort of really sort of makes you trying to determine who's MIB are responsible for this case and who's MIB are responsible for that case.
Boy, that's intriguing. Now, everyone, at this point, we're about to take a 10-minute break. But at the end of that time, in 10 minutes, we'll be right back for our second hour of the interview with Nick Redfern. Be right back. Welcome back to A Global Focus and the second hour of our interview with guest Nick Redfern, author, journalist, and media consultant. Nick Redfern's latest book, The Real Men in Black. Welcome back, everyone, to our interview. And, Nick, before we discuss the contactee and final events works, I just had to mention a case because, you know, Nick, I had heard of this happening too. I can think of a particular case where a craft morphed in its image, and you relate the MIB account of a Colin Bennett, a ufology researcher, which occurred in Notting Hill, West London. Now, if I'm correct, Colin and his girlfriend at the time, Mary, also observed some of this event. The event was a morphing craft. It appeared at first as a powerful light in the sky above, and then it transformed into a British Lancaster bomber of World War II vintage, and then into a triangular-shaped craft. That's fascinating. And then after they had seen this craft morph, they went into Mary's apartment, and for some reason an MIB had appeared on scene. That's one interesting account.
Yeah, this is a weird one. I mean, a lot of people sort of associate the Men in Black just with the United States, but it's very much a worldwide phenomenon, and certainly the case of Colin, which occurred in the early 1980s, is a classic example. And as you rightly point out, they had an encounter with what arguably you would call like a shape-shifting UFO, to the point where, you know, it sort of really freaked Colin out, and they had this strange Man in Black experience where this guy in black suit, but essentially they just let him in the house. Mary let him in the house or the apartment at the time, and he was sort of claimed to be wanting to visit somebody who lived in the apartment above. There was nobody there, and asked if he could wait, but then automatically brought the subject matter around to the issue of this UFO and didn't seem remotely surprised by the experience, seemed very interested in learning about Colin's views and perceptions on what had occurred, to the point where it seemed that he was literally on the scene to gauge the response of the witnesses to this encounter. And Colin viewed it as sort of very weird experience, because it was almost like logic had gone completely out the window, to the point where neither he nor Mary gave much thought at the time as to why, you know, the MIB had been invited into the home, you know, late at night, a complete stranger, but they just, you know, Mary just opened the door to him and let him in, which normally you would not do. And, you know, it was almost as if the MIB had some sort of control and sway over her thinking or her mindset, if you like. So, you know, I think in that respect, it again serves to demonstrate the stranger aspects of the phenomenon. Certainly Colleen, who has written a number of well-received books on UFOs, has never forgotten this experience sort of nearly 30 years on, and it's, you know, it's a classic sort of more modern-day encounter with the MIB rather than, as many people assume, you know, they're just something of the 1940s or 50s.
Thank you for that response. Very intriguing. Now, you know, Nick, I wish I'd written down the name of this particular MIB experiencer, but you reference a ufologist in your book who was studying the Arthurian legends and possible archaeological sites, and that he had actually seen a lovely woman MIB, but perhaps her counterpart in male MIB form on another occasion. We have, from Nora's Boy, again an excellent researcher here, another question, and it's relating to this Arthurian subject matter. Why is there a portal to a hellish world under King Arthur's tomb? Is this Christian king and first Christian site in England built over top of this portal to keep demons from entering the world? He thought it was a very peaceful and inspiring site. Now, it could be a reference, too, that Norris Boy has a wonderful website of his own regarding the ancient sites, mounds, tells, that sort of thing, ancient abbeys.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, bear in mind, this is, you know, as I point out in the book, this is the theory of one man, a man named Colin Pert. Colin was someone I first met back in 2001. Met him for the only time in 2001, but corresponded with him briefly on and off for a couple of years later. And he was someone who had a deep interest in the legends of King Arthur and became pretty much, I think it's fair to say, obsessed with searching for the final resting place of King Arthur. And he dug, you know, very, very deeply into Arthurian legends and trying to find the final resting place of King Arthur. And he claimed to me that on one occasion, at the height of his research, he was visited by what we might call a definitive woman in black. You know, a lot of people talk about the men in black, but women in black, you know, the cases certainly aren't as prevalent, but they do exist, you know, and you know, from all around the world, and they seem to display the same characteristics. They turn up late at night, they issue these sort of veiled threats and warnings, and they kind of, you know, have this same imagery where they make it like a veiled threat, but it's not like an open, overt threat. They kind of let the witness join the dots, and that was certainly the case with Colin, that this woman in black supposedly said, "You're on the verge of uncovering things that there are certain people in government don't want you uncovering, and I'm here to give you sort of like a friendly warning to leave your research alone and stay away from looking for the final resting place of King Arthur, because it's essentially, as she described it to Colin, as like a portal or a doorway to a realm in which negative entities could come through if you understood the sort of ways and teachings of, you know, the ancients, if you like. Now, bear in mind, this is simply what Colin said he was told. You know, we never can really be sure, and he's now deceased, he died a couple of years ago, but we can never be really sure, you know, as to what extent he was being told the truth or deceived. So, you know, all I can really do is relate the story as he told it, but he was basically visited by this sort of beautiful-looking woman in black who gave this sort of slightly menacing, weird message, which he kind of took heed of, but at the end of the day was of a mindset, well, I'm still going to look into it, whatever the outcome. And he was given a veiled warning by the woman before she left, that if he didn't heed her warning, he would receive another visit from something far worse than her. And he said to him, he actually had two experiences, one in the middle of the night where he had like a classic sleep paralysis type experience where he woke up to see this strange creature, not unlike the Mothman as he described it, like a almost like a winged glowing eyed gargoyle type creature looming over him in bed, warning him to stay out of the King Arthur research and or, you know, the worst fate of all would sort of be. And this happened on a number of occasions to the point where for several years he did drop out of research, but eventually sort of gravitated back towards it, and he came round eventually to sort of like a line of thinking that this gargoyle type glowing eyed creature and the woman in black were actually one and the same, that she was some sort of paranormal shapeshifter, if you like, whose job it was, again, to sort of divert people from looking into sort of esoteric, you know, ancient historical mysteries like King Arthur. And I thought, you know, as I point out in the book, all I can do is sort of recount what the witnesses state, and, you know, I tried to do that without speculation, and Colin, I think, did the same to me. You know, he told the stories that was related to him by the woman, and the experiences that he had, you know, and I think we can speculate forever and a day as to, you know, where the truth lies in the story, and, you know, what the motivations might have been on the part of the woman in black in, you know, trying to get him out of research, so to speak.
Boy, that's interesting. Thank you, Nick. And, you know, on this interesting abilities and connection of the Men in Black, you also reference an intriguing September 1976 case of a Dr. Herbert Hopkins. Mm-hmm. He was regressing through hypnosis, a reported abductee, David Stevens. Interestingly, he had received a call from a person alleging to be a representative of the New Jersey UFO Research Organization, which didn't exist. When he agreed to meet with the gentleman, he appeared right away. And then I'd love to have you further reference this. This MIB seemed to transform during the visit a silver coin to a vaporous substance and then nothingness. That sort of speaks of alchemy.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, this is probably without, well, I say probably, it is without doubt one of the strangest of all cases I relate in the book. Dr. Herbert Hopkins, who was involved in a UFO investigation in the mid-1970s and received this bizarre, very bizarre visit from this man in black that, you know, when you read the account, it sounds nothing at all like a, you know, a government agent of any sort whatsoever. Hopkins claimed that he received this visitation late at night when he was alone on Saturday night and his wife and children had gone out to the cinema and he was staying at home. He received this call asking if a certain person from a UFO group that history showed actually didn't exist when the investigations were undertaken, if he could come round and speak to the doctor, and Hopkins said, well, okay. Bear in mind, this is sort of pre-cell phone era. But within seconds, there was a knock on the guy was actually seen coming up the yard towards the front. And Hopkins said, you know, there were no phone booths in the area at all, and obviously there were no cell phones back then. And yet the man in black appeared just literally out of nowhere and sort of stood patiently on the front doorstep waiting to be let in by Hopkins, who let him in. And as I point out in the book, that kind of parallels some of the ancient mythologies about vampires who have to be invited into the home of the person before they can enter. And so, you know, in that respect, it's sort of a strange, weird phenomenon, so to speak. And the man in black, how he looked was just as weird. He was described as being sort of pale, white. He was completely hairless, not even sort of like telltale stubble on his head or chin or anything like that at all. Just looked totally, you know, it's like a type of creature that just had no bodily or facial hair at all. And seemed to have sort of, you know, colored lips and face, if you like, as if he was trying to make himself look more like us than just some sort of pasty, semi-human looking creature. And the experience was actually quite menacing for Hopkins, because the MIB said to Hopkins, you know, you have two coins in your pocket, don't you? Take them out. And it turns out that Hopkins did have two coins in his pocket, took them out, and one of them sort of made the coin sort of obliterated it into nothingness, one of the coins. And as you point out, this sort of has parallels with, you know, ancient stories of alchemy, where you have people, you know, trying to transform base metals into precious metals like gold. And what's interesting is if you look back into a lot of the early alchemists, a number of them claim to have been visited by dark-suited, mysterious men late at night who would demonstrate their sort of alchemical skills that would warn them of the dangers of dabbling into esoteric areas like this. And this sort of power, this is sort of, you know, the 1500s, 1600s, and yet it massively and eerily parallels the experience of Herbert Hopkins in 1976. So, you know, you have to wonder, how long have these MIB actually been around? You know, is it, as we perceive, a relatively new phenomenon, or is it something that, you know, goes back centuries, and what we're seeing today is just its current form, you know, but it may have had an ancient archetypal imagery, you know, going back a long, long time.
Heck. Boy, those roots, roots of the connections are really vast there. Thank you. That's very intriguing. Now, I had forgotten to note an important question here from the audience. It's one of our senior researchers, senior in knowledge, not years, Sandman. Now, his question is, considering the history of interaction from Men in Black, is it possible that a very relevant and immense figure will present him or herself to change the current direction of the world?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, when we look at the Men in Black, it's clear that their whole process of approaching people is to divert or direct the person either in this direction or away from that direction. Now, you know, to what extent, you know, it might influence the world, I'm not entirely sure. It's difficult to sort of comment to that extent. But what I can say is that, you know, the Men in Black don't just turn up to silence people or to, you know, say, don't talk about this case. It's almost, you know, they try and get people out of UFO research to actually, you know, so their lives are radically altered from its previous, the road it's traveling. You know, it's not just, don't talk about this case. You know, their entire aim, if you like, is to just radically alter what the person is doing in their life as it relates to UFOs. So, you know, you could argue that, you know, to what extent it would have an effect at a world level, I don't know. But certainly at a personal level, you know, people who've experienced the Men in Black, you know, they really do find their lives altered. Some of them even sort of suffer from like a post-traumatic stress type situation and paranoia driven by the experience. So, you know, whether it alters things at a world level, I don't know. But certainly at a personal level, you know, it has a profound, very negative effect on a lot of people.
Yes, indeed. Similar to the abductees, experiencers, sometimes being affected by that post-traumatic distress disorder of that particular type, the experiencer abductee type. Now, quick question here. I was thinking about Sandman's comment, but it really seems to dovetail into your book, Final Events and the Secret Government Group on Demonic UFOs and the Afterlife. Really enjoyed reading that. The other two books, the paperback copy version, this was on that Nook program of Barnes & Noble. Excellent.
Oh, yeah.
But now in that Final Events book, there is a reference to MIBs, and it also referenced that some people of this secret intelligence group, the Collins Elite, would like to disclose their concerns. Others still think it should not be disclosed to the public. And that really Sandman's comment could relate to that as well.
Yeah, I mean, the Final Events book is probably the most controversial book I've ever written. It deals with a think tank type group in the government that concluded that, yes, UFOs are real, but they concluded it had nothing to do with literal aliens and viewed the entire thing as kind of like a demonic deception. I mean a literal demonic deception, you know, sort of demons from hell, so to speak. And, you know, this aspect is one that sort of polarizes a lot of people into different camps. Some people accept it as, you know, being the answer. Others suggest, you know, no, it's got to be aliens. It can't be real demons, you know. And I didn't sort of write the book, you know, to promote the group's conclusions as facts. I wrote the book to demonstrate it's a fascinating story that there's a group in government that concludes, a think tank group that concludes aliens are actually demons. You know, it's an interesting story to tell as to how and why the group was created and how it came to these conclusions. But, I mean, one of the people I interviewed for that book and also for the Men in Black book was Ray Beauchesne, who's an Anglican in Nebraska and also a UFO researcher and a former state director for the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON. And Ray firmly believes that the answers to the UFO phenomenon can be found in, I guess, in demonology. And he believes that the Men in Black themselves have their origins, you know, in demonology, and that their role is to sort of, I guess, seduce people into the darker side of ufology and then get their grips into them and, you know, lead them into the world of the occult and the paranormal and, you know, to where it gets its grips into the person and then takes control of their life. And as Ray sees it, you know, from a very negative perspective, and the person, you know, sort of goes down this sort of troubling, disastrous path, if you like. So in that respect, you know, it's kind of, it's an area that some people, I think, actually find disturbing, the idea that, you know, we're not dealing with aliens, we could be dealing with deceptive, manipulative demons that sort of create imagery, if you like, almost like holographic imagery to try and convince us that they're alien when they're actually something different. Now, my personal view is, you know, I'm open to all different theories. I think we have a definitively known UFO presence amongst us. I don't rule out any theory until, you know, we know exactly what's going on. But, you know, I think more than anything else, as I said, the reason for writing the book was to demonstrate what I consider to be a very intriguing story, that there is a group in the government getting funding to look at the links between ufology and demonology. And I think that in itself is a significant story, regardless of whether or not people agree with the conclusions of the group.
Absolutely, and you know, I have to emphasize something here. Sandman is a senior ICAR researcher. He really comes up with excellent observations on different research points in the ufology field. I don't believe that he would espouse the viewpoint there of the Collins elite.
Huh.
Nick, it was an interesting book. I'll tell you two things, a couple of things that really surprised me about it. Number one, am I correct here? I quickly read this book. Your research led you to hear from someone at Nebraska's, is it the Offutt Air Force Base, who
yeah.
alluded to perhaps you're really having a need to contact someone with the Collins elite. That's interesting. That's where you learned that term for the first time?
Yes, it was. What happened was what I uncovered initially was that Ray Beauchamp, the Anglican priest who lives in Lincoln, Nebraska to this day and who's heavily involved in UFO research and still is, Ray had been visited by two representatives of the Department of Defense in 1991 and who wanted to get his views and opinions on the idea that the UFO phenomenon might be demonic, as Ray concluded. And these DOD guys wanted Ray's opinion on how he'd reached that view and why he'd reached that view, because they were coming to similar suspicions and similar conclusions as Ray. And so they wanted a bit of advice and guidance, even though, you know, they were senior people within the Department of Defense. They're actually physicists working on a particular project to try and contact these entities and sort of do it almost like a Faustian pact with them in some respects. And when Ray told me this story, it sort of set me on the trail of trying to determine, well, you know, what was the name of the project that these two guys worked on that visited Ray? And they were kind of like deep throats, you know, government people sort of spilling the beans on this secret group within government. And so that really set me on the path, and Ray gave me a few tips and data and names and things that I agreed not to publish. But, you know, Ray didn't have a problem with me sort of delving into this extra information, and it was that sort of led me into kind of like a very surreal situation I'd never really been into to a significant extent before, where, you know, I was contacting sort of, you know, elderly guys in their early 80s, you know, literally who had been around in sort of the early formative years of ufology in the late 40s, early 50s, investigating things for the government and coming to all sorts of sort of paranormal-themed conclusions to the UFO phenomenon rather than extraterrestrial. And, you know, it was kind of although I don't dig deep into this in the book because the publisher kind of wanted to just go with the story. But, I mean, some of the meetings were sort of strange. You know, it was a case of, you know, are you prepared to drive to this or fly to this particular Denny's, you know, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, at 12 noon and meet this elderly guy and he will answer your questions. And it was like that. That was literally the sort of the weird situation, you know, I found myself in for several months while I was immersed in the research for the book. I'll be the first to admit, you know, it was a very odd, almost, I won't say unsettling, I'm not sort of that type of character, you know, I don't get frightened either, but it was just an odd, surreal situation to find yourself in, where there were certain people who seemed to want to help get this story out about this demonic angle, but there were other people that felt it was too alarming and the public wouldn't be able to cope with it, you know. Even though it was just a theory, you know, there were people in government who said, there's no way we can tell the public this they just will not be able to handle the idea that, you know, demons are amongst us and manipulating us, and the government's trying to, the government's lost control of the situation, and they felt the better thing to do is to say nothing. Other people thought the public should know, and that no matter what the outcome, you know, we will, you know, we should share it with people and then just see where it goes from there.
Now, Nick, on this Collins elite, is this a global elite or one strictly within the confines of U.S. governmental intelligence and military organizations?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, as far as I can tell, at least, and I'm based, you know, based on the research I've done, I have to sort of answer it to the best of my ability. As far as I can tell, it's to be a U.S.-based group and conclusion. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean other agencies in other countries may not have, you know, followed a similar approach and may have come to similar conclusions. I'll be the first to admit, you know, that when you're delving into a subject like this and you have a limited number of sources to interview, you know, it's kind of like trying to get a full appreciation of the history of the FBI by interviewing 10 retired FBI agents. You know, you're only going to get a small insight from their perspective, and I suspect that's what I kind of, with the Collins elite, was that, you know, I think I got part of the story, but it wouldn't at all surprise me if there was, you know, a profoundly, massively large amount of material that I never even saw, and, you know, the group might be far more significant rather than just being this little think tank. You know, it might have strands all across the world. You know, I don't actually rule that out.
Thank you. That's very intriguing. Very intriguing book. Now, Nick, actually, I find your work so informative and so engaging, you can't put them down the minute you begin to read them. And this is the case with your book, Contactees, A History of Alien-Human Interaction. Now, Nick, we had an interesting discussion here in the UFO Paranormal Radio chat room here a couple of nights ago. We were so intrigued. It was on the account of Truman Bethorm with alleged individuals from Clarion in the 1950s while Truman was working in Nevada and Arizona. Now, what particularly intrigues me is the description of a contactee case championed by Paula Harris. The contactee, Maurizio Carvalho, mentions a race, the Clarions. Now, the Clarions, I believe, Clarion was the race, was the name that Truman Bethorm had referred to regarding that alien group that he encountered. Also, and I'm not going to name this person's name, there's one individual who also noted in text that she had heard of that name during encounters with other ETs or with ETs. Do you think there's a connection here? Is there a group Clarion that's making its presence known?
Well, it could be. I mean, one of the things I point out in the book, I think, you know, when it comes to the contactees and the so-called Space Brothers, or Space Sisters as they also became known, you know, we're sort of reliant on their words as to who they said they were and where they said they were from, and I think that's an important point to remember. And I do point out in the book, I think sometimes these sort of long-haired human-looking space aliens may well have been deceptive about their point of, not from a sinister perspective, but I guess kind of guardedly protecting themselves, so if anybody kind of came looking too closely, they could actually hide their presence, you know, because we know the government was deeply interested in this and was looking for them, and so it might make a lot of sense, you know, to sort of kind of direct people away from who you actually are, but, you know, by spreading, not the message, I think, was absolutely true, you know, that somebody was concerned about our warlike ways, but they may well have been, you know, careful about what they said to who and protecting their origins, you know, as a means to stay one step ahead of us. So, you know, I think the story of Truman Bethorm is an intriguing one because, you know, it has some weird strands to it of alien contact, but whether Truman was in some cases sort of misguided but given a real message to tell, I think that's a possibility. You know, he may have been deceived as to the origins, but the message, I think, was a valid one.
Thank you for that explanation. Very informative. Now, you know, Nick, in your coursework, you reference a number of very intriguing accounts from the various contactees. One I found very interesting was that of Air Marshal Sir Beresford Peter Torrington Horsley. Now, Air Marshal Torsley, I guess, became a wing commander in 52, and from 1953 to 56 served as full-time equerry to the Duke of Edinburgh. Now, I guess the prince apparently was very interested in ufology, ET subject matter, and Horsley did do a study and met the enigmatic Mr. Janus, an extraterrestrial. Comments on that? Boy, that's intriguing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is like a very interesting and profound story. I mean, Air Marshal Sir Peter Horsley was somebody who was at the forefront of, you know, the British military, kind of the equivalent of like Colin Powell was in the, you know, in the Department of Defense in the U.S. government. He was literally of that stature, and he claimed contacts in the 1950s with an alien entity that identified himself as Mr. Janus, who talked all about sort of you know, philosophical issues relating to, you know, aliens and their mission on Earth and how the human race was failing in its mission to sort of live in peace and harmony with each other. And they sort of had this philosophical discussion, and or I should say, to Peter Hawes, they had this philosophical discussion with this alien named Mr. Janus, which sounds a bizarre story, which it is, until you realize, you know, his significant position within the British infrastructure, the governmental infrastructure within the military. You know, he was no fool. He was a very, very high-ranking person. So this is what leads me to believe that even though a lot of these stories about human-like aliens trying to spread messages and, you know, get us to follow their teachings sound controversial, when you have highly credible people like Sir Peter Horsley relating these accounts, you know, it's impossible to just write them off as, you know, fantasy. That there is a real phenomenon, and there are these, you know, these experiences are genuine.
Yes, indeed. You know, I found those connections to be very, very intriguing. Now, you know, Nick, I'd like to discuss here an unusual case. Again, your contactee's work. It's of a Yugoslavian-born individual, Bosko Nedeljkovic, who allegedly worked for the Department of State's Agency for International Development in South America, and at a later point with the Department of Defense. Very intriguing links here, and in this particular chapter of contactees, there is a discussion of joint Brazilian and American missions which seem to affect or generate UFO incidents there.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, this is why the UFO phenomenon is so difficult to sort of get a real solid grip on what's going on, because, as I point out, with the story of Bosko Nedeljkovic, he said that, you know, there were some very significant, very real UFO incidents. There was absolutely no doubt about that. But to confuse the issue and also to gauge how people might react to UFO incidents, but people like the CIA had actually staged fake UFO incidents. You know, the theory was that if there was ever an alien invasion, whether good or bad, the CIA and the government would need to know how the general public might react. And because they couldn't predict how the public would react, because UFO incidents recur at random, occasionally they staged incidents and carefully watched the witnesses to see how they reacted. You know, did they react? Did they go into deep shock? And if you could gauge the reaction in a staged event, you could potentially, you know, have some inkling of an idea of how people would react in a real situation. And Nedeljkovic talks about how a number of contactee cases that he was aware of had been staged by government agencies as a means to try and gauge the reaction of the general public to a real UFO incident. But that didn't negate the fact that there had also been real contact cases. So, again, you know, we have this, like with the MIB cases, we have a crossover between real UFO events and government manipulation of UFO events as well. And I think, again, that's one of the chief reasons why resolving the matter is so problematic, because it's not just it's this or that. It's like there's this blurry combination of several things going on.
Yes, indeed. That very well put there. Now, Nick, in your book, you also reference the work of Mac Tonnies, which he's a researcher who believes that subterranean creatures could be responsible for experiencer events, including abductions, that these beings are actually crypto-terrestrials. Do you think that could be true in certain cases?
Yeah, I think this is, you know, it's like Josh Warren's time travel theory. I mean, this is a really interesting theory, the idea that at least some UFO experiences and encounters might not be incidents involving, you know, literal aliens, but they could be events involving ancient terrestrial races. You know, we hear a lot of stories about, you know, the legends of Atlantis and things like that, where reportedly in the distant past, you know, there were highly advanced species of human that were far in advance in many respects of humanity today. And something happened in the distant past, you know, there's some sort of catastrophe or disaster, and, you know, they were obliterated, and all we have today are the legends and the myths. But Mac speculated on the theory that maybe, you know, these ancient, highly advanced races and cultures didn't die out, but perhaps as the human race, you know, our species, kind of increased its position on the planet and became the dominant force, they, when their civilization collapsed, they may have sort of retreated underground into deep caves and caverns, but still occasionally surface because to keep an eye on us, because they're forced to share the planet with this fairly warlike species known as the human race. But they look quite like us, and they can move amongst us, and, you know, they just have a few subtle differences in their appearances, which might account for the space for the stories, might even account for the Men in Black mysteries. And it could also, as Mac rightly said, explain why the people flying the UFOs seem so concerned about our warlike ways, because they're forced to share the planet with us. You know, it would be ironic if our aliens actually are, or some of them, are ancient terrestrial species, you know, like an offshoot of the human race. You know, in turn, we're Homo sapien, but before us, you know, there are Cro-Magnon men, Neanderthal. Maybe there was a highly advanced offshoot, you know, of a different variety that we just don't know about, and maybe some of them are still around and responsible for some, at least, UFO cases. I think that's an intriguing theory, and it's one, you know, definitely worth looking into.
You know, yes, indeed, that really presents a very interesting scenario, doesn't it? Also, Nick, in your book, you do reference the Raelian movement. Mm-hmm. I find it remarkable that an organization in the ufology field could attract the type of investment that the Raelian movement has. And what a transformation for Claude Vorion to now being that group's prophet is what I would describe it. Very interesting individual. And I remember, too, years back in 2002 with CloneAIDS announcing the cloning of the child Eve. Also, I've always been intrigued by their focus on seeing that embassy in Israel.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the Raelian movement is an interesting one, because what we see, this is something we see throughout the contactee movement, is that the contactee phenomenon seems to attract literally thousands upon thousands of people, whether it was George Van Tassel in the 50s with these conferences out at Giant Rock that attracted audiences at their height of about 12,000, or the Raelian movement, you know, which has literally tens of thousands of followers. And again, you know, the scenario is of very human-looking aliens with a philosophical, positive background interacting and contacting people, you know, of the human race, like Claude Vorion, and, you know, suggesting they set up a movement to, you know, promote the work of the aliens. And you know, I do find it notable that in the contactee movement, probably more than any other aspect of the UFO phenomenon, this is the one aspect, the contactee aspect, where people do become galvanized to follow it, and, you know, to where it becomes a literal movement. And certainly, you know, that's the way I would describe the Raelian group. It is now a definitive movement with a solid, gigantic following all around the world. And, you know, I think this sort of speaks volumes about the power of the UFO phenomenon to alter human perception and, you know, for people to challenge existing paradigms and things like that and think outside the box. And the contactee movement, I think, perhaps more than any other aspect of the UFO phenomenon, allows for that sort of massive personal change to occur.
Yes, it does. Creative thinking, innovation.
Yes.
Now, you know, Nick, I'm thinking now of another person you've mentioned in your contactees book, Dr. Frank Strangis. He has passed now. I didn't have the opportunity of meeting him in Hawaii. He's written a number of books. Yes, and he has written a number of books, including Stranger at the Pentagon, detailing the alleged activities of Val Thor from Venus. It was an intriguing book. I also remember their reference to a craft being, I believe, moored at Lake Mead in Arizona. But I did think Dr. Strange's book, Stranger at the Pentagon, was an interesting read. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, again, a lot of these contactee stories are highly controversial. Mm-hmm. Frank Strange's was no exception. You know, this book, Stranger at the Pentagon, it essentially dealt with, I guess, what you would call alien infiltration of the U.S. government, but largely from a benevolent perspective, where human-like aliens were infiltrating the military, the Pentagon, the government, to try and impact upon the angle or the approach that the government was following, and trying to infiltrate, and I guess not necessarily maliciously, but to subvert governmental thinking, to try and have the country become more amenable to the idea of alien visitation, and to manipulate us almost, it's probably the right term to use, into changing society to a more positive stance. But in saying that, when you read Strange's book and some of the other contactee books, while the so-called space brothers sound benevolent, there's also an angle where, if we don't go along with what they say, it's like, well, we can actually make things pretty bad for you. You know, it's like they're actually friendly to an extent, but it's like, well, follow what we say, be good. If you don't, well, things can happen. So it's almost like a paternal warning almost, to the kids kind of thing, to sort of stay in line and everything will be fine. And I think that sort of comes through a little bit in Frank's books, that, it's a controversial story, but it's no more controversial than many of the other contactee accounts. And to me, I truly do believe that there were people in the 50s, particularly, who did have these experiences with I think some of the experiences may even, as I point out in the book, have been more visionary than physical, that the phenomenon behind the UFO mystery may have sort of manifested before them in a visionary form to try and instill a message in the mind of the person they targeted, and they kind of provoked a vision that was acceptable and understandable to the people of the time, the sort of long-haired human-looking alien. So I think, something was contacting these people like Frank Strangis and like George Rantasil with a view to spreading their word and, have these people go out on a mission, so to speak. To what extent, the people were actually exposed to these entities in their real form, or whether it was a visionary experience provoked by an alien intelligence, as I suspect, I think we can look at it in, from several angles along those lines.
Yes, indeed. And Nick, at one point, I forget which book, but it was very powerful, the thought that you expressed, that the intelligences can dictate what we perceive. And my question would be, both to you and just philosophically as well, your thoughts are brilliant on this. How can the experiencer or abductee more sharply focus in on these intelligences to find greater detail and accuracy in what they're experiencing?
Mm. Well, I think, there's in my mind that there's a genuine UFO phenomenon that's of unknown origins. I think from reading a lot of accounts and speaking to a lot of witnesses, that the phenomenon appears to have the ability to sort of morph and change its appearance to suit the people of the time. You go back 500 years, people having missing time experiences with small creatures that at the time they perceived as goblins and, pixies and fairies and things like that. Today, they're, the black-eyed greys. But the archetypal experience is the same. The person has an encounter with a diminutive, highly advanced entity. They're taken to some weird twilight realm, or today to the interior of a UFO. They experience missing time. And there's a reproductive, human reproductive angle to it as well. Today, it's to save the ailing alien race. 500 years ago, the person was taken to the fairy kingdom to mate with the fairy queen. But there's actually not that much difference between the archetypal imagery. It's just the, you know, the, it's been upgraded. It's almost like the program's been upgraded for a modern audience. And I think there's a great deal to the idea that certain UFO experiences that appear 3D, maybe visionary-like, and the UFO phenomenon is almost creating like a living hologram, which the witness becomes immersed in to teach them something. And that it then has them go on the mission, if you like, to spread the word. And, you know, people are literally chosen at random, possibly. You know, almost like an alien disciple. You're going to be chosen to spread the message that we want spread. And I think there is something to that. And I think, you know, this obviously brings up issues related to the nature of reality and perception, the entire UFO experience, but it doesn't take away from the fact that there is a UFO experience at the end of the day.
Absolutely. Very well said. And you know, Nick, just briefly on that holographic reference, that brings to mind discussions of possible research and development into the hologram area, and also the research of Guy Malone's wife, her pen name being Paradox Brown. Now, I think, we have 5 more minutes. Excellent. Nick, you are an expert in so many fields. One of them I'd like to mention now is the fact that you run the United States office for the British-based, now what is this, Center for Freudian Zoology. Very impressive. I can't wait. Now that I've read 3 of your books, I want to read all of them because they're very informative, very intriguing, very engaging. I'm thinking now on the subject of Bigfoot. We did have a visit here from a person with the nick Texas Cryptid. You spoke at the 2004 Texas Bigfoot Research Conference. You know, we've actually had a Bigfoot sighting more up in the Boulder, Colorado area. Also, Colorado Springs has had a sighting. Are there any projects there in cryptozoology here, right in the American continent, that presently intrigue you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, Bigfoot's a deep fascination of mine because there are always sightings ongoing. You know, but I think one of the things I've found, like with the UFO subject, is that, you know, Bigfoot, there's more to Bigfoot than just a hidden ape that society, that's conveniently, you know, thwarted every attempt to catch it or kill it. I think there's something very weird about Bigfoot, that it isn't just elusive, it's almost too elusive. And although, you know, a lot of mainstream cryptozoologists, cryptozoology being the study of unknown animals like Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster or the Yeti, a lot of mainstream cryptozoologists take the view that these creatures are just simply animals that science has yet to classify properly. But there's a lot of high strangeness at Bigfoot, and I think that these entities, whatever they are, they may well have the ability to sort of flit in and out of our reality from one realm to another, and that's why they are so elusive. I don't think Bigfoot is just an unclassified type of ape. I think it's highly advanced. I think it has paranormal overtones, and I think there are reasons as to why it constantly eludes us, and it almost sort of flits in and out of almost existence or reality, and I think that's why it's been so difficult to solve the mystery. You know, we're finding new species of animal, granted often small animals all the time, and yet we cannot capture 7 to 8 foot tall apes inhabiting the most highly populated and advanced country in the Western world. To me, that suggests there is something weirder about Bigfoot. You know, it's a genuine mystery, it's a real creature in some respects, but I think, like a lot of these cryptozoological creatures, they're not just simply what they appear to be. They're far, far more significant and far weirder as well.
That multidimensional aspect of the Bigfoot study, very true. You know, it's funny, Nick, I actually did on a Bigfoot, how would you call it, sortie or adventure. It was going to be, I believe, near Bartlesville, Oklahoma. Love Oklahoma. And at that time, I was just too busy that week. I was studying for some important tests, but boy, I wish now I'd gone. I've also heard that there have been several sightings in Texas, too, particularly.
Yeah, a lot of people, you know, think Texas is just desert and plains, which West Texas is, but East Texas is heavily forested. There's an area of East Texas called the Big Thicket. very large area of woodland and forest where there have been a lot of very intriguing Bigfoot reports. Actually, a good friend of mine, Rob Riggs, wrote a book called In the Big Thicket, which was a study of sort of hairy wild man and Bigfoot type creatures in that area. But they've also been associated with sightings of weird floating and flying balls of light in the same vicinity where the Bigfoot creatures have been seen. And people have talked about seeing these creatures vanish in the blink of an eye, and they've stalled car engines and all sorts of strange things. So that's, you know, again, what leads me to believe that, you know, that the Bigfoot mystery has probably less to do with zoology and far more to do with, you know, sort of things like quantum physics, which allows for the existence of multi-dimensions and things like that.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, your expertise extends the full spectrum. Here, when you were mentioning those balls of light, you also have an interesting reference in your MIB book, and we're coming to the close of the show, to Matthew Williams, a crop circle expert, who even when constructing a crop circle with a friend, had anomalous balls of light appear, yeah, and then towards him. And these light phenomena seem to be sentient. That's really intriguing.
Yeah, I actually think some of the UFO phenomenon, as I said, is like visionary. And I point out, particularly in the Contact Tea book, I think some of these balls of light, these so-called ghost lights, as they're known, are sentient beings in their own right. They may not be flesh and blood. They may be pure energy that have a high degree of intelligence. And I think they can literally manipulate the human mind to essentially appear in like a holographic form that, as I said, is applicable to the people of the period. So they may not be seeing, you know, physical 3D thing, but they're seeing an image created by the phenomenon which wants to have some sort of interaction with the relevant person, and it does, and it appears, you know, probably in a form that plucks imagery out of the subconscious of the person and then, you know, manifests in a form that that person can relate to, if you like, from this culture or that country or wherever.
Absolutely. Nick, I hope so very much that you'll be a return guest to this program. I found the discussion and your books so very informative. Please be a return guest soon. Have a wonderful weekend. Very strongly encourage our audience members to read Nick's books. They're an excellent read. You learn a great deal from them. Thank you again, Nick. Much appreciated. And thank you again to our audience for listening. Great weekend, everyone.
Thanks, Trace. Thanks a lot. Good night.
Thank you, Nick. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening this evening to A Global Focus with guest Nick Redfern. Your time with us is appreciated, and we look forward to your joining the discussion each Friday evening on A Global Focus. Have a great weekend.